Hayden, of course, had done more than his part to accelerate this transformation. A spy agency that on September 11, 2001, had been decried as bumbling and risk-averse had, under the watchful eye of four successive CIA directors, gone on a killing spree. During the long, hot summer in Pakistan in the months after Osama bin Laden's death, the CIA killed a string of al-Qaeda operatives, including Atiyah Abd al-Rahman, who had been bin Laden's tether to the outside world during his time in hiding in Abbottabad. Some in Washington likened President Obama to Michael Corleone during the final minutes of The Godfather, coolly ordering lieutenants to dispatch his enemies in a calculated burst of violence. 35 years earlier, after the toxic details about the CIA's efforts to kill foreign leaders seeped into public view, President Gerald Ford ordered a ban on assassinations that he hoped would prevent future presidents from being too easily seduced by black operations. But in the decades since the September 11 attacks, legions of U.S. government lawyers had written detailed opinions about why the targeted killing operations carried out by the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command, far from declared war zones, didn't violate President Ford's assassination ban. Just as lawyers for President Bush had redefined torture to permit extreme interrogations by the CIA and the military, so had lawyers for President Obama given America's secret agencies latitude to carry out extensive killing operations. One of them was Harold Coe, who had come to Washington from Yale Law School, where he had been the school's dean. He had been a fierce critic from the left of the Bush administration's war on terror, and had decried the CIA's interrogation methods, including waterboarding, as illegal torture. But when he joined the government as the State Department's top lawyer, he found himself spending hours poring over volumes of secret intelligence in order to pass judgment over whether men should live or die. In speeches, he offered a muscular defense of the Obama administration's targeted killing operations, saying that in a time of war, the American government was under no obligation to give suspects normal due process before putting them on a kill list. Still, in moments of public reflection, he spoke of the psychological burdens of spending so much time reading the biographies of the young men the United States was debating whether or not to kill. As the dean of Yale Law School, I spent many, many hours looking at the resumes of young 20-year-olds, students in their 20s, trying to figure out which ones should be admitted, he said during one speech. I now spend a comparable amount of time studying the resumes of terrorists, same age, reading about how they were recruited, their first mission, their second mission. Often I know their background as intimately as I knew my students. In the midst of the surge of drone attacks, President Obama ordered a reshuffling of his national security team. The result was something of a grace note at the end of a decade during which the work of soldiers and spies had become largely indistinguishable. Leon Panetta, who as CIA director had made the spy agency more like the military, was taking over the Pentagon. General Petraeus, the four-star general who had signed secret orders in 2009 to expand military spying operations throughout the Middle East, would run the CIA. In his 14 months at Langley, before ignominiously resigning over an extramarital affair with his biographer, Petraeus accelerated the trends that Hayden had warned him about. He pushed the White House for money to expand the CIA's drone fleet, and he told members of Congress that, under his watch, the CIA was carrying out more covert operations than at any point in its history. Within weeks of arriving at Langley, Petraeus even ordered an operation that, up to that point, no CIA director had ever done before: the targeted killing of an American citizen. By the time Petraeus took over the CIA, an owlish, bespectacled preacher with a bushy black beard and a message of rage had ascended to the top of America's kill list. The list coordinated in the basement office of John Brennan, the White House counterterrorism advisor. With bin Laden dead and the punishing campaign of drone strikes thinning al-Qaeda's ranks in Pakistan, counterterrorism officials in Washington began to devote more attention to the threat from Yemen and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That meant hunting down and killing Anwar al-Awlaki. Al-Awlaki had taken a strange path to being designated as an enemy of the United States. Born in New Mexico in 1971, he spent his early years in the United States while his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, a prominent Yemeni who would go on to serve as President Saleh's Minister of Agriculture, studied agricultural economics at New Mexico State University. Nasser moved the family back to Yemen 7 years later, where Anwar lived until returning to the United States for college in the early 1990s. At Colorado State University, Anwar won the presidency of the school's Muslim Student Association, but was not comfortable with the rigidly conservative strand of Islam, with its prohibitions on sex and alcohol that some of his fellow students practiced. He stayed in Colorado after graduation, and to his father's chagrin, he began preaching at a mosque in Fort Collins. Nasser had wanted his son to enter a more lucrative profession, but within a few years, Anwar had moved to San Diego to take a position as an imam at a mosque at the edge of the city. His views gradually grew more conservative, and he preached about living a life of purity. But in his private life, he sometimes strayed from his own teachings. He was picked up multiple times by the San Diego police for soliciting prostitutes. More significantly, in 1999, the FBI began investigating al-Awlaki's ties to militant suspects in the San Diego area, suspicions that rose partly from his work for a small Islamic charity. He would even come into contact with two future September 11 hijackers, Khalid al-Mikdar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, who both prayed at his mosque and attended conferences with the cleric. But the FBI inquiries into his work unearthed no criminal activity, and by the time of the September 11 attacks, al-Awlaki had resettled in Northern Virginia, where he was preaching at a large mosque in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. He infused his sermons with references to pop culture and American history, and he soon got his first taste of media stardom when he began getting calls from reporters to help explain the basics of Islam to American newspaper readers. He was even considered something of a voice of moderation, participating in an online chat for the Washington Post about Ramadan and attending a Pentagon prayer breakfast. "We came here to build, not to destroy," he said during one sermon, calling himself and other imams in America the bridge between Americans and 1 billion Muslims worldwide. But his message would soon turn darker. After a police crackdown on Muslim charities and other Muslim-owned institutions in 2002, al-Awlaki lashed out publicly about how the Bush administration's war against terrorism had become a war against Muslims. Shortly afterward, he moved to London, where he enthralled young Muslims who attended his fiery sermons and those who listened to his lectures on CD recordings, which he sold in a boxed set. But even as his fame grew, he had trouble supporting himself in the United Kingdom, and in 2004 he returned to Yemen, where he used internet chat rooms and eventually YouTube to transmit his sermons globally. The fact that his sermons were delivered in English limited his influence in the Muslim world, but his virulent anti-American rhetoric spurred a sliver of his followers to action. One of them was Omar Farouk Abdulmuttalib, the young Nigerian student who would try to set off a bomb hidden in his underwear while on an airplane descending into Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. Months before, Abdulmuttalib had written an essay about his reasons for wanting to wage jihad and sent it to al-Awlaki. As American investigators began piecing together the failed Christmas Day plot, they began to get a better understanding of the role al-Awlaki played within al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The 38-year-old American man who had once spoken about being America's bridge to the Muslim world was not merely an inspirational prophet for the digital age, a peddler of internet hatred. He had put deeds to words and had begun helping the terror group plot a wave of terror against the United States. John Brennan, who maintained close ties to Saudi intelligence officials and had already been running much of America's clandestine war in Yemen from the White House, believed that it was al-Awlaki who was principally responsible for a shift in the al-Qaeda affiliate strategy. While the group had long thought globally, it had acted locally by focusing its attacks on targets inside Saudi Arabia. But when bin Laden and his followers in Pakistan were under siege, ACAP saw the opportunity to pick up the mantle as America's chief tormentor. Brennan believed that al-Awlaki was pushing the group increasingly in this direction. This may or may not have been the case, but inside the National Security Council, officials began debating an extraordinary matter: whether to authorize the secret killing of al-Awlaki, an American citizen, without capturing him or bringing him to trial. Harold Coe and other government lawyers began studying the raw intelligence about al-Awlaki's role inside the Yemeni militant group, and within months of Abdulmutallab's failed attempt to blow up the jetliner, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel had produced a classified memo giving the Obama administration approval to kill the renegade American cleric. Because al-Awlaki had a senior position inside al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and had declared war on the United States, the memo argued, he no longer had a constitutional right to due process. And yet the United States hadn't a clue where al-Awlaki or any other top ACAP operatives were hiding. Joint Special Operations Command had just begun ramping up its efforts to collect intelligence in Yemen, and the Obama administration was almost entirely dependent on the spies that Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh and Saudi Arabia's intelligence service had planted around the country. And after the botched American strike in May 2010 that accidentally killed the deputy governor in Yemen, Saleh had put even more restrictions on American activities there, and the clandestine war had ground to a halt. Slowly, however, the strong man in Yemen began to lose his grip. President Saleh had maintained power for decades by expertly manipulating the various factions inside the country, often pitting them against each other in a fashion that one Bush administration official had likened to dancing in the snake pit. But by early 2011, Yemen had become caught up in the street revolts spreading across the Arab world, and a government that once could barely control territory beyond the capital now couldn't even keep order there. Then, during an attack on the presidential palace in June, a barrage of rockets struck the room where President Saleh was hiding and knocked him to the floor. He suffered from internal bleeding in his skull, and the fires from the attack burned 40% of his body. Saleh's bodyguards put the wounded leader on an emergency flight to Saudi Arabia, where he spent hours in surgery. He survived, but his days as president were over. Ali Abdullah Saleh was no longer around to dictate what the United States could and could not do in his country. The CIA and JSOC had used the year-long pause in the American air war in Yemen after Deputy Governor Jaber al-Shabwani's death to build up a network of human spies and a web of electronic eavesdropping around Yemen. At the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, more analysts were assigned to monitor cell phones in Yemen and to penetrate computer networks in the hope of intercepting email traffic. And very quietly, the CIA began to build a drone base in the southern desert of Saudi Arabia to serve as a hub for the al-Qaeda hunt in Yemen. Saudi Arabia had given permission to the CIA to build the base on the condition that the kingdom's role be masked. Said one American official involved in the decision to build the base, the Saudis didn't want their face on the operation. Until the CIA base was ready, Yemen was still JSOC's war. In May 2011, the Pentagon began sending armed drones over Yemen, flown from Ethiopia and Camp Le Monnier in Djibouti, the hardscrabble former French Foreign Legion base where a small group of American Marines and Special Operations troops had operated since 2002. The buzzing of the drones became a regular sound in some of Yemen's most remote expanses of desert, and a cat-and-mouse game between the jihadis and the killer machines began. One Yemeni journalist, after spending 2 weeks with ACAP leaders, described the security procedures the group enacted to avoid being hit from the air. If a Yemeni jet fighter was approaching, they remained in place because, as the militants told the reporter, the Yemeni planes always missed their targets. If an American drone began buzzing overhead, they did the opposite. They shut off their cell phones, hopped into trucks, and began moving because the drones can't bomb moving targets. The militants had figured out one of the weaknesses of the drones, a problem created by flying the planes by satellite. Because drone pilots were separated from their airplanes by thousands of miles, what the pilots saw on their screens in the United States was sometimes several seconds behind what the drone was watching. The problem, known as latency, had for years made it difficult for targeting officers at the CIA and the Pentagon to figure out where to aim the missile fired from the drone, which explains some of the civilian casualties and missed targets of the drone wars. Being in a moving truck allowed Al-Awlaki to narrowly escape death in May 2011, just days after the commando raid in Pakistan that killed bin Laden. A human source spying for the Americans provided information that Al-Awlaki was riding in a truck in Shabwa province, and the JSOC team sent drones and Marine Harrier jets to the area. But the first American missile missed Al-Awlaki's truck. And when clouds moved into the area and obscured the view of the planes, Al-Awlaki was able to jump into another truck and drive in the opposite direction. The American planes continued to follow the first truck, and a missile strike killed two local Al-Qaeda operatives in the vehicle. Al-Awlaki took refuge in a cave. According to Yemen scholar Gregory Johnson, Al-Awlaki later told his friends that the incident increased my certainty that no human being will die until they complete their livelihood and appointed time. At the White House, President Obama and John Brennan were growing frustrated that JSOC kept missing Al-Awlaki and other top leaders. A year and a half since Obama had expanded American clandestine activities in Yemen, no senior ACAP leaders had been killed and a number of strikes had been carried out with faulty intelligence. More civilians had been killed than militant leaders. Flying armed drones over Yemen was an improvement over cruise missiles, but Djibouti's government would not allow the United States to launch any lethal missions from Camp Le Monnier without first getting its approval. JSOC leaders bristled at the restrictions. The CIA operated under no similar restrictions, and by September 2011, the drone base that the spy agency had built in the Saudi desert was completed and ready for use. David Petraeus, who by now was CIA director, ordered some of the agency's fleet of Predator and Reaper aircraft from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia. Spy agencies also repositioned satellites and reconfigured data networks to allow the drones to communicate with pilots back in the United States, and they carried out the other technological work required to open a new front in the drone war. And the CIA had something beyond drone aircraft parked close to Yemen's border. A source within Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula who began providing regular information about Al-Awlaki's movements. The CIA had already collected intelligence about ACAP's structure and had managed to get an advanced look at the group's glossy internet publication, Inspire, each time before it was published. ACAP had used the magazine, written in English, to raise its profile and to incite would-be jihadis in the United States or the United Kingdom to wage war close to home. Major Nidal Hassan, an Army psychiatrist who killed 13 people in a crowded military facility at Fort Hood, Texas in November 2009, was a reader of Inspire. So was Faisal Shahzad, a junior financial analyst living in Connecticut who 7 months later tried to detonate a van full of explosives in the middle of Times Square. One Inspire article, written by the magazine's Pakistani-American publisher, Samir Khan, carried the title, Making a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom. Each time they were given a sneak peek at Inspire, Obama officials debated whether to sabotage the magazine before it went online or insert messages into the text that might embarrass ACAP and set off alarms inside the group that a Saudi or American mole might have penetrated its ranks. But they decided against it, in part because they worried that anyone suspected of helping them might be executed. But there was a second reason. Since Inspire could be read online in the United States, any efforts by the CIA to manipulate its content might violate laws prohibiting the agency from carrying out propaganda operations against Americans. These same concerns had led the CIA to mostly abandon its propaganda operations since the advent of the Internet, when Americans sitting in front of laptop computers could read news and information that had been written thousands of miles away. The vacuum had allowed the Pentagon and people like Michael Furlong to fill the void with a new kind of information warfare tailored for the digital age. Impressed by the CIA's record of targeted killings in Pakistan, White House officials took the hunt for Anwar al-Awlaki away from the Pentagon and gave it to the CIA. On September 30th, a fleet of American drones took off from the base in Saudi Arabia, crossed into Yemen, and began tracking a group of men riding in a convoy across Al-Jawf province, an expansive desert near the Saudi border, once renowned for breeding Arabian horses. The men had stopped to eat breakfast when, according to witnesses, they spotted the drones and rushed back to their cars. But the drones had locked onto their target, and what followed was a carefully orchestrated symphony of destruction. Two Predator drones pointed lasers on the cars, a tactic that improved the accuracy of the missile strikes, and a Reaper drone fired missiles that delivered a direct hit. Every man riding in the convoy was killed, including American citizens Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, a diabolical propagandist and the creative force behind Inspire. Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, the imam's skinny 16-year-old Denver-born son, had slipped out of the kitchen window in his family's house in Sana'a 2 weeks earlier. It was the only home he had known since he moved to Yemen as a young boy after his father had become famous in the United States and the United Kingdom for his inflammatory sermons. In the years since, his father became the Obama administration's most hunted man and fled Sana'a for the relative security of Yemen's remote provinces, but Abdul Rahman mostly lived the life of a normal adolescent. He entered high school with an interest in sports and music, and he kept his Facebook page regularly updated. In the middle of September 2011, he decided he needed to find his father wherever he was hiding. Before sneaking out of the house, he left a note for his relatives. "I am sorry for leaving," he wrote. "I am going to find my father." He went to Shabwa province, the region of Yemen where Anwar al-Awlaki was thought to be hiding and where American jets and drones had narrowly missed him the previous May. What Abdul Rahman did not know was that his father had already fled Shabwa for Al-Jawf. He wandered about, having little idea what to do next. Then he heard the news about the missile strike that had killed his father, and he called his family back in Sana'a. He told them he was coming home. He didn't return to Sana'a immediately. On October 14th, 2 weeks after CIA drones killed his father, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki was sitting with friends at an open-air restaurant near Azan, a town in Shabwa province. From a distance, faint at first, came the familiar buzzing sound. Then missiles tore through the air and hit the restaurant. Within seconds, nearly a dozen dead bodies were strewn in the dirt. One of them was Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. Hours after the news of his death was reported, the teenager's Facebook page was turned into a memorial. American officials have never discussed the operation publicly, but they acknowledge in private that Abdulrahman al-Awlaki was killed by mistake. The teenager had not been on any target list. The intended target of the drone strike was Ibrahim al-Banna, an Egyptian leader of ACAP. American officials had gotten information that al-Banna was eating at the restaurant at the time of the strike, but the intelligence turned out to be wrong. Al-Banna was nowhere near the location of the missile strike. Abdulrahman al-Awlaki was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Although the strike remains classified, several American officials said that the drones that killed the boy were not, like those that killed his father, operated by the CIA. Instead, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki was a victim of the parallel drone program run by the Pentagon's Joint Special Operations Command, which had continued even after the CIA joined the manhunt in Yemen. The CIA and the Pentagon had converged on the killing grounds of one of the world's poorest and most desolate countries, running two distinct drone wars. The CIA maintained one target list, and JSOC kept another. Both were in Yemen, carrying out nearly the exact same mission. 10 years after Donald Rumsfeld first tried to wrest control of the new war from American spies, the Pentagon and CIA were conducting the same secret missions at the ends of the earth. 2 months after his son and grandson were killed, Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki mourned their deaths in a video eulogy he posted on YouTube. Dr. al-Awlaki spoke for nearly 7 minutes in clear, deliberate English. "Loyal Muslims must keep his son Anwar's message alive," he said, "and spread it to all those who had not yet been touched by his words." He pledged ominously and without further detail that his son's blood did not and will not go in vain. Dr. al-Awlaki described America as a state gone mad, enthralled with a strategy of assassinations in the darkest corners of the world. "The attacks had become so routine," he said, "that the strikes that killed his son and grandson went almost unnoticed inside the United States." This was partly right. On the day Anwar al-Awlaki was killed, President Obama made brief mention of his death during a speech, calling it another significant milestone in the broader effort to defeat al-Qaeda and its affiliates. But by the next day, the killing of the firebrand preacher, an American citizen whose death had been authorized by a secret Justice Department memo, received no mention on network nightly news broadcasts. 2 weeks later, barely any attention was paid to the killing of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, the skinny American teenager. The drone strikes remained a secret, at least officially. The Obama administration has gone to court to fend off challenges over the release of documents related to CIA and JSOC drones and the secret legal opinions buttressing the operations. In late September 2012, a panel of three judges sat in front of a wall of green marble in a federal courtroom in Washington and listened to oral arguments in a case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union demanding that the CIA hand over documents about the targeted killing program. A lawyer representing the CIA refused to acknowledge that the CIA had anything to do with drones, even under cross-examination from skeptical judges who questioned him about public statements by former CIA director Leon Panetta. In one case, Panetta had joked to a group of American troops stationed in Naples, Italy, that although as Secretary of Defense he had a hell of a lot more weapons available than at CIA, the predators weren't that bad. At one point in the court proceeding, an exasperated Judge Merrick Garland pointed out the absurdity of the CIA's position in light of the fact that both President Obama and White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan had spoken publicly about drones. "If the CIA is the emperor," he told the CIA's lawyer, "you're asking us to say that the emperor has clothes even when the emperor's bosses say he doesn't." But for all the secrecy, drone warfare has been institutionalized, ensuring that the missions of the CIA and the Pentagon continue to bleed together as the two organizations fight for more resources to wage secret war. Sometimes, as in Yemen, the two agencies run parallel and competing drone operations. Other times, they carve up the world and each take different parts of the remote-controlled war, the CIA in Pakistan, for instance, and the Pentagon running the drone war in Libya. It was July 2004 when the 9/11 Commission concluded that the CIA should give up its paramilitary functions. It made little sense, the commission concluded, for the CIA and the Pentagon to both be in the business of waging clandestine wars. "Whether the price is measured in either money or people," the commission's final report stated, "the United States cannot afford to build two separate capabilities for carrying out secret military operations, secretly operating standoff missiles, and secretly training foreign military or paramilitary forces." The Bush administration rejected this recommendation, and in the years since, the United States has moved in the exact opposite direction. The CIA and the Pentagon now each jealously guard different parts of the shadow war's architecture, a drone base in Saudi Arabia, a former French Foreign Legion base in Djibouti, and other remote outposts, and are loath to relinquish any control as politicians embrace targeted killing operations as the future of American warfare. Meanwhile, the Pentagon continues its push into human spying. The Defense Intelligence Agency is hoping to build a new cadre of undercover spies, hundreds of them, for spying missions in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. "Everything is backwards," said W. George Jameson, a lawyer who spent 33 years at the CIA. "You've got an intelligence agency fighting a war and a military organization trying to gather on-the-ground intelligence." Throughout the grueling presidential election season of 2012, President Obama frequently alluded to targeted killings as a sign of his toughness, speaking with braggadocio reminiscent of President Bush during the early days after the September 11 attacks. Once, a reporter asked him about accusations made by Republican presidential candidates that his foreign policy amounted to a strategy of appeasement. "Ask Osama bin Laden and the 22 out of 30 al-Qaeda leaders who've been taken off the field whether I engage in appeasement," Obama shot back. "Or whoever is left out there. Ask them about that." For all their policy differences during the 2012 presidential campaign, Obama and Governor Mitt Romney found nothing to disagree about when it came to targeted killings, and Romney said that if elected president, he would continue the campaign of drone strikes that Obama had escalated. Fearing such a prospect, Obama officials raced during the final weeks before the election to implement clear rules in the event they were no longer holding the levers in the drone wars. The effort to codify the procedures of targeted killings revealed just how much the secret operations remained something of an ad hoc effort. Fundamental questions about who can be killed, where they can be killed, and when they can be killed still had not been answered. The pressure to answer those questions eased on November 6, 2012, when a decisive election ensured that President Obama would remain in office for another 4 years. The effort to bring clarity to the secret wars flagged. A nation fatigued by the long, bloody, and costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan seemed, by the end of President Obama's first term, little concerned about their government's escalation of clandestine warfare. Quite the contrary. According to one poll conducted for Amy Ziegert of Stanford University, the country had, to a remarkable degree, become increasingly hawkish on counterterrorism matters. A large majority, 69% of respondents, said they supported the American government assassinating terrorists. Targeted killings have made the CIA the indispensable agency for the Obama administration and have even improved the agency's image on other matters. According to the same poll, 69% of respondents expressed confidence that American spy agencies had accurate information about what was happening inside Iran and North Korea. This was more than 20 points higher than a similar poll had found in 2005, when the CIA was being slammed for the botched assessments about Iraq's weapons programs. Interestingly, the 2012 poll was conducted just months after North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il died, and CIA officials hadn't learned of his death until it was announced several days later on North Korean television. But gradually, the risks and opportunity costs of a muscle-bound CIA are becoming evident. After the CIA was surprised during the first weeks of the Arab Spring, the agency reassigned dozens of case officers and analysts to study what was happening in the Middle East and North Africa. And once again, the Obama administration also turned to CIA officers to play the role of soldiers rather than spies. As the revolution in Libya escalated into open civil war, the CIA sent paramilitary officers and private contractors to the country to establish contact with rebel groups and help ensure that the tons of machine guns and anti-aircraft weapons flowing into Libya were channeled to the right rebel leaders. President Obama insisted that no American ground troops be used in the war to drive Gaddafi from power, relying instead on the formula that his administration had come to trust: drones, clandestine officers, and a cadre of contractors that had been empowered to use the Libyan rebels as a proxy army. But the CIA had precious little real intelligence about the rebel groups, and some of the rebels that the United States had empowered in Libya turned against their patrons. Just after 10 p.m. on the evening of September 11, 2012, a small CIA base in Libya received a frantic call from the American diplomatic compound just a mile away in a different part of Benghazi, the port city on the Mediterranean Sea in eastern Libya, where the American government had established a beachhead after Muammar Gaddafi's fall. The diplomatic compound was coming under fire, the State Department officer at the other end of the line said, and attackers carrying AK-47s were beginning to stream through the facility's main gate. Already the mob had taken gasoline cans and set one of the buildings on the compound ablaze. The operatives at the CIA base, who had come to Benghazi to try to prevent Gaddafi's arsenal of shoulder-fired missiles from getting into the hands of the militant groups that had splintered off from the rebels now in charge in Libya, gathered their weapons and drove in a two-car convoy to the diplomatic compound. They had failed to convince a group of Libyan militia fighters to join them in the rescue effort, and when they arrived at the compound, a fire was raging. J. Christopher Stevens, the American ambassador to Libya, was trapped inside one of the buildings. The building's ceiling had collapsed, and the CIA team was unable to reach Stevens, who suffocated from the intense smoke. Circling overhead, a military drone that had been diverted from a separate mission was beaming video of the firefight into the headquarters of U.S. Africa Command in Germany. But the Predator was unarmed and incapable of providing any help to the badly outnumbered team of Americans. Unable to hold their positions any longer, the CIA operatives and State Department security officers evacuated the diplomatic compound and drove to the CIA base a mile away. But not long after they arrived, the CIA base came under a barrage of fire from AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades. It wasn't until 5 a.m. when a group of American reinforcements arrived from Tripoli and joined the CIA operatives on the roof of the base. By then, the attackers were preparing to stage another assault, and mortar shells began exploding on the roof. CIA operatives Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty, both former Navy SEALs, were killed. By dawn, the Americans had evacuated the CIA base and were driving to the airport, the Predator keeping watch over the convoy from the sky. All American personnel, together with the bodies of the four people killed during the assault, were flown to Tripoli. U.S. operations in Benghazi, which had been the CIA's primary base for gathering intelligence in Libya, were shot down. The attack had, quite literally, blinded the CIA inside Libya. And, with the agency's decade-long pivot toward paramilitary operations, there is concern among the ranks of both current and former spies that the agency might be blind in too many other places as well, for a different reason. The CIA's closed society has fundamentally changed, and a generation of CIA officers is now socialized in war. Just as a generation earlier, Ross Newland and his training class had been told that the spy agency should eschew killing at all costs, many CIA officers who joined the agency since September 11, 2001, have experienced only manhunting and killing. This new generation has felt more of the adrenaline rush of being at the front lines than the patient, gentle work of intelligence gathering and espionage. The latter can be tedious, even boring, and as one former top CIA officer put it, "How are you going to keep these people on the farm now that they've seen the bright lights of the city?" Some senior CIA officials speak with pride about how the drone strikes in Pakistan have decimated Al-Qaeda, forcing the dwindling band of Osama bin Laden's followers to find new places to hide, in Yemen or North Africa or Somalia or some other ungoverned part of the world. Many believe that the drone program is the most effective covert action program in CIA history. But in the killing years since 2001, some of those who were present at the creation of the CIA's drone program and who cheered the lethal authorities the spy agency was handed after the September 11 attacks had become deeply ambivalent. Ross Newland still praises a weapon that allows the United States to wage war without carpet-bombing enemy territories or indiscriminately lobbing artillery shells into remote villages in Pakistan, but he thinks that the CIA should have given up Predators and Reapers years ago. "The allure of killing people by remote control," he said, "is like catnip. And drones have made the CIA the villain in countries like Pakistan, where it should be the spy agency's job to nurture relationships for the purpose of gathering intelligence. The Predator," Newland said, "ends up hurting the CIA. This just is not an intelligence mission." Richard Blee played an even more critical role at the dawn of the drone age. As head of the CIA's ALEC station, the unit inside the counterterrorist center with the specific mission of finding Osama bin Laden, Blee was among a small group of counterterrorism zealots who chafed at the restrictions placed on the spy agency in the years before the September 11 attacks. Together with his boss, J. Cofer Black, Blee pushed for the CIA to be given lethal authority to kill bin Laden and his minions. During the summer of 2001, he stood in the middle of California's Mojave Desert, watching as missiles fired from a Predator destroyed a mock-up of bin Laden's Tarnak Farms training camp. Weeks later, he watched in agony as thousands died on September 11th, wondering whether he and his colleagues could have pushed harder to prevent the attacks. On his desk, he still keeps a piece of rubble from the destroyed replica of Tarnak Farms. He has left the CIA, and in the years since his retirement, he has been burdened by doubts about the wisdom of the CIA's targeted killing mission. As the bar for carrying out lethal action lowered, and the agency was given permission to launch missiles in Pakistan and Yemen when American spies weren't even certain whom they were killing, so-called signature strikes, he grew dismayed. What had originally been conceived as a device the United States might use selectively was being abused, Blee thought. In the early days, for our consciences, we wanted to know who we were killing before anyone pulled the trigger, Blee said. Now we're lighting these people up all over the place. The pistons of the killing machine, he said, operate entirely without friction. Every drone strike is an execution, Blee said. And if we are going to hand down death sentences, there ought to be some public accountability and some public discussion about the whole thing. He paused. And it should be a debate that Americans can understand. About an hour outside of Las Vegas, after the stucco houses of the city's suburbs have disappeared and the landscape has turned into low, creosote shrubs and spiky Joshua trees, the highway swings to the west and descends into a valley. A cluster of low, beige buildings appears in the distance, and above them a small plane resembling an insect flies slow, lazy circles in the sky. It rises over a cluster of hills to the right of the highway, turns to the left, and touches down on a runway carved out of the desert sand. The town of Indian Springs, Nevada, elevation 3,123 feet, can be seen in a 3-minute drive. It's mostly a collection of RV parks and mobile homes served by 2 gas stations, a motel, and Auntie Moe's trading post. A billboard above the post office advertises the nearest chain amenities, Denny's, Subway, Motel 6, 1 hour ahead. The small casino where Kurt Hawes and his team had a celebratory breakfast in February 2001 after making history by firing the first missile from a Predator still sits at the edge of town. But like the rest of Indian Springs, it's mostly empty. Thanks to a new bypass road, it's no longer a stop for tourists on their way to Death Valley from Las Vegas. The lonely town has reaped none of the benefits of the robust growth taking place just across the highway, behind miles of fencing and guard posts where armed soldiers deny entry to the curious. It was in the middle of the last decade that Indian Springs Air Force Auxiliary Field was renamed Creech Air Force Base, and the ramshackle windswept base where the early Predator test pilots tinkered with a new way of war began its transformation into ground zero for American killing operations overseas. Sitting on 2,300 acres of desert, Creech is now so busy that the Air Force is hoping to expand the base by buying land from local businesses, a move that could render Indian Springs even more of a ghost town. Both the Pentagon and CIA fly drone missions out of Creech, and military personnel and civilian contractors involved in the drone program still commute to the base from the Las Vegas suburbs, pulling shifts in long, sand-colored trailers lined up into neat rows. Sometimes they fly training missions at Creech, navigating the Predators and Reapers near the base, honing their deadly skills by tracking civilian cars and trucks driving along lonely roads. But mostly the pilots are fighting a war thousands of miles away, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, and across the great desert expanse of North Africa. In the weeks after the September 2012 attack on the American diplomatic compound in Libya, the skies above Benghazi filled with the buzzing sound of American drones sent there to track down the perpetrators of the attack. At the edge of the Nevada base, washed-out red cement barriers carry a proud message. Creech AFB, home of the hunters. Epilogue. A Spy in Leisure World. A quote from Dewey Claridge. This is where the business is going. Dewey Claridge fell down. A year after the Pentagon shuttered his private spying operation, Claridge stumbled in his house near San Diego and broke several bones. The accident put him in the hospital, where he was more ornery than usual, and forced him to relocate to the East Coast to be closer to his family. The 79-year-old former CIA officer, the founder of the agency's counter-terrorist center, one of the principal public villains of the Iran-Contra scandal, and the man who once bragged about coming up with the idea of mining the harbors of Nicaragua while he was drinking gin, moved to Leisure World. He rented an apartment in one of the high-rise towers that dominates Leisure World's leafy campus, 25 miles from Washington, D.C., a retirement village trying to reel in baby boomers by marketing itself as the destination for the ageless generation. A Yankee Republican born during the Depression, Claridge was hardly a boomer and generally detested much of what the generation had come to represent. I drove out to meet him in June 2012, unsure of what kind of a reception I would get. I had written a good deal about Claridge, and much of it I knew he didn't like. But he greeted me warmly when I pulled up to the Italian restaurant on the retirement village's property, where Claridge appeared to be the only customer and had taken a table to enjoy the late afternoon sun. He looked like any other retiree. He was dressed in a salmon-colored shirt, unbuttoned at the top to allow the gold chain around his neck to peek out. He wore sneakers and white socks, and somehow was tanner than he had been when living in San Diego. He told me he had adjusted to his new surroundings, but complained that his cats were less than pleased. "Everyone here has dogs, those little dogs." It was a bit ironic that Claridge was now living just miles from the CIA, an agency he viewed largely with scorn, but he didn't seem to miss California or lament his move back to the East Coast. "This is where the business is going," he said. By the business, he meant the private intelligence business. And he was right. The drive out of Washington to the exurban retirement village cut through the gleaming glass towers and sprawling office parks of Northern Virginia that, over the past decade, had sprouted almost from nothing. America's defense and intelligence industries, once spread throughout the country in places like Southern California and the Midwest, had gradually consolidated and relocated to the Washington area. The companies chose to move closer to what they called the customer, the Pentagon, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and other intelligence services. Government contractors, large and small, now form a ring around the Capitol like an army laying siege to a medieval town. The private military and intelligence business was booming. By 2012, the global battlefield had stretched America's secret army beyond its capacities. The CIA and other intelligence services had outsourced some of their most essential missions to private contractors who were being hired for espionage missions and to carry out intelligence analysis. They were hired to support CIA drone operations, from sitting in ground control stations in Nevada to loading missiles and bombs onto the drones at classified bases in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Jeffrey Smith, a former general counsel for the CIA and now partner in a prestigious Washington law firm, represents some of the companies that have won black contracts for doing military or intelligence work. "It is stunning," Smith told me, "how much the American government has outsourced the basic functions of spycraft to private contractors, many of the companies led by former CIA officers and special operations troops, who promise they can do a better job than federal employees." Eric Prince sold off Blackwater and moved to the United Arab Emirates, but other companies took its place, companies that do a far better job staying out of the headlines than Blackwater did. As the American way of war has moved away from clashes between tank columns outside the declared war zones and into the shadows, a cottage industry has materialized to become an indispensable part of a new military intelligence complex. Smith sometimes bristles at the relentlessly negative portrayal of private contractors, but he also sees the potential for trouble if the needs of the mission conflict with a company's profit imperative. There's an inevitable tension as to where the contractor's loyalties lie, he said. Do they lie with the flag, or do they lie with the bottom line? By the middle of 2012, Michel Ballerin was still trying hard to win another long-term government contract for her work in Africa, and she saw opportunity in the chaos that was spreading across the northern part of the continent. After radical Islamists took over a vast stretch of desert in northern Mali, and after it became clear that Washington once again was struggling to get intelligence about a country it had long ignored, Ballerin told me she was making contacts with Tuareg rebels in the eastern part of Mali and was hatching a plan to drive Islamists out of the country. She didn't elaborate. Her planning wasn't limited to Africa. Ballerin was looking for investors for a new project to build a fleet of seaplanes modeled after the original Grumman G-21 Goose, planes that she thought the American military could use to land troops in remote locations that didn't have working airstrips. She was even scouting business opportunities in Cuba that might make her rich once Fidel Castro finally died and communism in Cuba came to an end. That summer day in 2012, it seemed very unlikely that Dewey Claridge would ever again dip his cup into the stream of government money going to intelligence contractors. His operation with Michael Furlong had concluded ignominiously, and Furlong had quietly been forced into retirement. Claridge was still angry about how the episode ended. As he saw it, it was yet another example of bureaucrats in Washington protecting their turf at the expense of soldiers in the field who desperately needed the intelligence he could provide, if only to avoid relying on the CIA. But he said he was determined to stay in the game. He told me he still kept his network of informants in Afghanistan and Pakistan, some of whom could be maintained on a shoestring budget. If Washington was too foolish to make use of his people, he said, maybe another friendly government might be more enlightened. He lit a cigar and turned philosophical. I think the Treaty of Westphalia is over, he said. He was talking about the 17th century peace accords in Europe that ended the 30 Years' War, three bloody decades of fighting among kings and emperors who sometimes used mercenaries as cannon fodder for the major battles. The Treaty of Westphalia, most historians agree, led to the birth of modern nations, standing armies, and national identities. Nation-states no longer have a monopoly on military force, he said. It was corporations and private interests, he said, that would be the future of America's wars. Just look at our own system. The only thing that isn't outsourced is the guy shooting the gun. It was a rare moment when Dewey Claridge was actually understating a situation. At times since the attacks of September 11, 2001, the United States had even outsourced the trigger pulling. Whether it was Eric Prince, Enrique Prado, and Blackwater hired by the CIA to hunt terrorists, or hired muscle like Raymond Davis driving through the streets of Lahore with a Glock semi-automatic in his glove box, or private soldiers dodging mortars during an all-night firefight on the roof of a CIA base in Benghazi. The chaotic first years of America's shadow war had seen the United States willing to farm out government's most elemental function, protecting the state. It was getting late, and I got up to leave. Claridge decided to stay and finish his cigar. We shook hands, and I walked to my car. Driving away, I glanced back at Dewey sitting alone at the table of the retirement home's empty restaurant. A thin trail of cigar smoke curled up into the dying light.
The End. You've been listening to The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth by Mark Mazzetti. Narrated by Richard Ferrone, and directed by Innocenti Aksentiev. We conclude this book with a note on the sources. It is a great challenge to write an account of an ongoing war that, at least officially, remains a secret. This book is the result of hundreds of interviews in the United States and overseas, both during my years as a national security reporter and during my book leave from the New York Times. I tried as much as possible to convince the people whom I interviewed to speak for the record, and those who agreed are cited by name both in the main text of the book and in the endnotes. I also conducted scores of interviews on background, where I allowed sources to speak anonymously in exchange for their accounts of American military and intelligence operations, the vast majority of which remain classified. Although this is hardly ideal, I believe it is a necessary evil to ensure that trusted sources are able to speak candidly. Using anonymous sources is always a risk, and as a national security reporter, I have learned that some sources can be trusted far more than others. For this book, I have relied heavily on people whose information I have come to trust over the years. I have tried as much as possible to draw on open source material and declassified government documents. In this effort, I have been helped by the work of several different organizations. The National Security Archive at George Washington University works tirelessly to get government documents declassified under the Freedom of Information Act, and I am enormously grateful for their efforts. The Site Intelligence Group is the best resource for monitoring the writings and public statements of militant groups in Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, and other countries, and I have drawn extensively on Site's work. A large number of the U.S. government documents cited in this book were first made public by WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy organization. The WikiLeaks database has become an important resource for journalists and historians trying to better understand the inner workings of American government. I am deeply indebted to the many people in several different countries who gave up countless hours of their time to let me interview them. They trusted me to tell their stories, and this is their book as much as it is mine. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Secret History of MI6 by Keith Jeffrey, narrated by John Curlis. Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, also commonly known as MI6, was born a century ago amid fears of the rising power of other countries, especially Germany. The next 40 years saw MI6 taking an increasingly important and, until now, largely hidden role in shaping the history of Europe and the world. This thorough, fascinating, and revelatory account draws on a wealth of archival materials never before seen by any outsider to unveil the inner workings of the world's first spy agency. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.